Last one from Radio EduTalk here at the OER Conference 16 in Edinburgh. And just sitting in the hot seat, and I mean that most sincerely because this is the warmest room in the house, I think. I've got Martin Poulter and Simon Thompson at DigiSim and at ML Poulter on Twitter. And we're just going to have a wee chat about the day, how you think it went, if anything interesting caught your mind. Martin, you were sort of, I was going to say curating, but sharing a stream, was it the hacking stream you were sharing today?
Yes, indeed. I think this day has brought me down to earth because I think of open and open education as kind of utopia that we're working towards. And I kind of work in a utopia because I work in Wikipedia and Wikisource and Wikibooks, these sort of very ideally open, sharing, massive community projects. And here we've had lots of sessions about the practicality and the difficulty of making this change in institutions, in universities, museums, libraries, which have a long history and have like resistance to change and sometimes a natural fear. And so we've seen in a kind of strategic talks that we've just had from Oxford University and the National Library of Scotland that people are wary, but there's great gains to be made from opening up. And in terms of being valued as an institution, valued as an academic. And in the session I chaired, that was about hacking, making, sharing. And we had different projects. There's an anatomy textbook that a student from the University of Leicester has made in his spare time, and he's crowdsourced improvements to it. So it's incomplete, it's got errors, but people can suggest comments, and he gets a steady stream of comments and has improved it gradually, and that's a free and open resource, and it's become a whole family of sites. And so there are these great success stories against the background of the gradual process of cultural change we're trying to bring about.
I think I would agree. I think I've been involved in the OER program since 2009, and I think what we tried to do at the outset was define it. And like you say, we have to be careful that we don't put ourselves in a danger of saying to people, that's not open enough. Because for some people, just a little bit of open is enough. And I think iTunes U is a great example where the purist of open will say, that's not open. It's like a closed system, you know. But for some people, that is the start of their journey into open. And I was on a panel session today where we were discussing openness and repositories, you know, and I use Merlot with staff that I work with. I say to people, look, this is a repository that contains open material, but for the purist, it's not open because, you know, it's a membership kind of model, a peer review model. So in the essence of aspirational openness, it's not. And I think we have to recognise that. The journey of open starts and finishes at different places for people, and so I think we should avoid trying to create this utopian kind of openness. We should realise that open is different for different people and celebrate that, not say to them, actually, that's not open enough. And so we have to avoid being the critics of other people's open because we might have a dream or a vision of what the open world should look like.
Is it John? This terrible
Scully,
Scully at the end was talking about a road.
Yeah.
And I guess what you're saying is we should be celebrating the milestones rather than saying it's a long way to Tipperary, you know.
Or even celebrating just where we are on that road. You know, if somebody's just stepped on it, brilliant, great. Let's not criticise them because they're not near a finish line. Or we should just say wherever you are on that open journey is absolutely brilliant.
I'm kind of uncomfortable with some of the discussion today. In this phrase, open-ish, has cropped up again in different sessions. Mm-hmm. I think it's Therese Bird from the University of Leicester who said Flickr and Khan Academy, a lot of these things, aren't strictly open, but they're open-ish. Yes, it's better than being closed. I've been involved in open projects, so-called, which have released things under a not fully open license. And I really regret it. There's content I've released, I can't use now, I can't remix it because I was too cautious. And it's a good thing working, again, in Wikimedia, where we can only accept fully open. It's got to be freely reusable by anyone for any purpose, or we can't take it. And it's actually good to have that absolutist kind of fundamentalist approach as a negotiating position. Because even this textbook we discussed, it's available under a non-commercial, non-derivatives license. So you can freely access it and you could copy it, but you've got to ask permission to do anything with it. And my point is, well, when the students who write this get fantastic jobs in medicine research and they haven't got the time to answer the email or update the site, what's going to happen to it? There's lots of projects that end up in the graveyard because they're tied to a particular server and people could take them and make derivatives and update them and give them a new life, but the license doesn't allow them to.
But I think that's all part of this open road, you know. I think, you know, we have to realise for some, Wikipedia and Wikimedia are domain areas that they just don't feel comfortable in engaging with. You know, there's a certain technical requirement that is potentially a barrier for some around that. But them going to Flickr, and instead of just searching for a picture, searching for one that's Creative Commons licensed, is a movement in the right direction. And we should be celebrating that and not saying to them, well, actually, that's okay, but what you should really be doing is... Because then that just gets people going, oh, crikey, I thought I was starting the journey and already you've put this fence across the road.
Well, I think you can see that coming. And I was just thinking this radio site that we've got is sitting and we've got several thousand pieces of audio that have been donated to us. And we started off using a share-alike license because quite a lot of teachers you talk to are not happy that somebody may make some money out of what they're doing. And obviously I've realised after having a lot of photos on Flickr for many years and never anybody ever making any money out of them that it's probably better just to let it go. But the trouble is once you've got that license on, as you say, I don't know how to go back to somebody who was at a conference in 2009 and contributed a bit of audio. Now, I can't go back to 2,000 people and say, do you mind if I change that license? I don't think they would care. But
it's a loss. It's a dead weight loss.
Yeah.
It's a gain relative to not having
this
at all. But then it's a
loss. Interesting conundrums and things because you can see the benefits of both. Because a lot of people aren't going to dive into the deep water.
But I'm really glad at this conference we're not really talking about technology, as Katie mentioned. And we're not even talking about particular licenses or details. We're talking about people's psychological comfort zone.
That's right.
And how they work and how fast we can move them. And that's a more interesting area to be working in.
Okay. And I think as a community, we're maturing. You know, if you look at how the licensing models have matured, you know, Creative Commons has extended licenses, you know, to the point now where you've got public domain, where you just basically say, go use it as you will. There's no need for attribution. So even ourselves as a community are evolving our concept of ownership and openness. So it is a continual journey. And what I try and do is I work with my academic colleagues is say, you don't have to be at the end of the journey, the right at the end of the road, which is this kind of open nirvana where, you know, everything is, you know, well constructed openly, everything is shared on a platform that is going to remain there for hundreds of thousands of years, but they might start at the very beginning of the journey, and we have to celebrate that with them, otherwise they'll just think, well, there's no way I can get to that, because already you've setting all of these like milestones that I have to achieve.
Would you give it a grudging nod?
I'm doing a lot of grudging nods. I make someone like the bad guy.
No,
We've got to praise people for incremental change.
Yes,
but we do need the Nirvana vision. We do have to have that there, otherwise we'll never have this kind of development or progress. And we are making progress, and we should celebrate that as well, because we're very critical, I think, of the fact we're not where we might want to be. But, you know, we have to recognise that we have made a lot of progress over the last 5 or 6 years.
So we're probably not going to get to Nirvana tomorrow, but is there anything particularly you're looking forward to tomorrow or you think people should look out for or think about?
I think because obviously the theme of the conference is around culture And as Martin mentioned, culture is a very difficult thing to change. But I think the shift from conversation, from being content to culture, is showing a maturity. And so tomorrow what I'm hoping is in the sessions is, how am I going to pick out this theme of culture and take it back to my own local culture with a view to shifting it? And I think, whereas before I used to come to OER 16 and think, right, what practical, technical solutions can I bring to my institution? It's now, what cultural changes can I bring to my institution? So that is what I'm going to be aiming to do tomorrow, is pick out little tips and tricks for changing culture, because it's a much harder thing to do.
Nothing to add to that.
Nothing to add to that. Well, we just hang up now and go out for hopefully a nice dinner. And we'll, if you're listening, tune in tomorrow, please. Thank you very much, Martin and Simon. That was just great. I'm just going to hang up the broadcast now. Cheers, folks.